Thanks, Dan. Thanks a lot. Welcome to Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. We're approaching 3 minutes past five. It's January 15th, 2019. Hope you've had a good old Tuesday. Halfway through the winter now, are we? Are we? I think we are. If winter begins in December, I know it doesn't. But I always think December, January, February. So we're midway through winter. At least I think we are anyway. That's reason to be optimistic enough. Shall we do today's programme then?
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show. It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, in the second hour of the programme, I'll be welcoming back to the show Gerard O'Colmon. He's an Irish journalist based in Paris. He's a correspondent for the American Herald Tribune. He's often seen on RT. I like Gerard a lot. And we're going to talk about the Gilets Jaunes protests, how they started, how they've spread, not just around France, but in other parts of the world. We'll talk about Brexit as well, the Brexit betrayal, media manipulation and more besides with Gerard O'Colmon in the second hour. Before that, though, we were due to do this on Thursday, but I welcome back to the programme an old friend and a long-time contributor, Jim Fetzer. Jim, of course, is a doyen of critical thinking, Professor Emeritus at the University of Madison, Wisconsin. He's also a former Marine Corps officer. He's going to be sued. He's being sued by Lenny Posner, the father of four-year-old Noah Posner, who was murdered at Sandy Hook in Connecticut in 2012. It's very serious, this. In the absence of any comment from the other side, I'm going to be putting points of view to Jim, points made by the people of Sandy Hook, the people of Connecticut. Contentious stuff, this, but we'll do it as professionally and as fairly as we can. I have a lot of time for Jim Fetzer. I've always found Jim Fetzer to be a sincere man, and I believe that Jim Fetzer believes what he believes. But I've had to struggle with this one over the years. While there's a lot of genuinely bizarre things, some very bizarre circumstances around that school shooting, and some unanswered questions, I have no doubt. I can't shake my feeling that Lenny Posner and some of the other parents are genuine. Is that incompatible with thinking that there is something very wrong with the circumstances around the shooting? I don't know. I'm going to have a chat with Jim Fetzer about that in about 15 minutes' time. I will, of course, be happy to hear from you through Twitter. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. I'm sure you've got strong opinions about it. You might remember I interviewed Wolfgang Halbig a couple of times. Former school safety inspector, national school safety inspector, former Florida school trooper. He's also been sued by some of the families. And my exchanges with Wolfgang were fair. I put the points of view to him that those who think that these conspiracy theories are crazy, I put those points. I kept my own opinions out of it. I did due diligence. I was fair. I was balanced. But it ultimately ended up in the Richie Allen YouTube channel, the original YouTube channel, being deleted. It was one of the reasons they gave. Well, they didn't give any reason, but I suspect it was that particular interview that saw the end of the original channel. Anyway, enough of that waffling. We'll get into it with Jim Fetzer very, very shortly. So there's only one story in a very shortened monologue today. That's Brexit. MPs are going to vote beginning at 7 o'clock when they'll vote on amendments. They've got some amendments to vote on. Short time after that, they're going to vote on whether to back Theresa May's deal for leaving the European Union. They've labelled this the meaningful vote, and there's been 5 days of debate on this as we've led up to it. May has called for politicians to back her deal or risk letting the British people down. but many of her own MPs will vote against her, joining opposition parties, and it's expected that she's going to get a hiding. And they're harking back to 1924. They're saying the defeat that she is facing will be the worst defeat ever faced or ever endured by a sitting Prime Minister since back in 1924. Now, if you've been watching Sky News or the BBC today, you might have noticed that behind the temporary outside broadcast units they've erected, because the media has been broadcasting from Westminster for weeks now, behind those temporary outside broadcast units are a sea of European Union flags, wall-to-wall blue with yellow stars. Yeah, there's an occasional Union Jack in there, and I saw one, but only one, leave means leave poster. But it's a sea of EU flags. Isn't that kind of interesting? Isn't it, my friend? Just a bit interesting, isn't it? You know, last week the media created a story about fascists and racist Brexit supporters. The media then stayed away for a day or two after Anna Soubry was allegedly harassed and Owen Jones. But then the media came back, and today it's very difficult to spot a Brexit supporter there. Listen to Kay Burley. This is recorded around 2:45 this afternoon or thereabouts. She's introducing two guests. Listen carefully to what Burley says.
So let's speak to Tom Harwood, who is a reporter for Guido Fawkes and the former leader of the student wing of Vote Leave, and the journalist and author Rachel Shabby. Hello to you both. Thanks for joining us. I've described this as a carnival atmosphere today. How would you describe it?
I think that's a very polite and generous way of putting it.
Okay.
What about Bill's slightly irritating, isn't it?
Well, you should have been here a couple of weeks ago, trust me. But there doesn't seem to be the division that we have seen over the last few weeks. One wonders what will happen over the next few weeks once the Prime Minister loses his vote, which he will probably undoubtedly do tonight.
Mm. 'Tis a carnival, said Kay. 'Tis a carnival, and we don't see the division that we have seen. But there are no Brexit supporters, you ginger knobhead. You know, that's why you have unity. Like I said, it's been a sea of blue flags with little yellow stars. I did like the fact, though, that Rachel Shabby, the journalist, was having none of it. She could see through it, and she could see what Sky News was doing, and she wasn't impressed.
I've described this as a carnival atmosphere today. How would you describe it?
Listen to Shabby.
I think that's a very polite and generous way of putting it.
She's basically told Burley to F off there. It's a very polite and generous way of putting it. Shabby was visibly horrified by what Burley was doing, basically going beyond editorialising. Look at all the unity we have here today with all these EU flags behind us.
Okay.
What about Bill's slightly irritating, isn't it?
Well, you should have been here a couple of weeks ago, trust me.
Yeah, it was really bad a couple of weeks ago, but we sorted all that out now, and we've just got EU flags. But Kay was outdone by the BBC this morning, BBC Radio 5, which is a news and sports channel. Now, remember how often you were told growing up, this was rammed down your throat, about the professional standards of the BBC and the ethics, no bias and all of that. Remember all that crap you were fed growing up about the BBC? Remember, listen to BBC Radio 5 Live at 7 a.m. on the dot this morning.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, the 15th of January, an historic date in the course of British politics and the future of our country. Today, MPs will finally vote on a deal that would bring to an end our membership of the European Union and help define our place in the world for generations to come.
It is 2.5 years since the country voted to leave the EU, and the nation still seems to be divided, with brutal battles in Parliament, new tribes forming, and leading characters being slain along the way. And it all comes down to this moment, a final rallying cry before the end game.
This is a news channel now. This is a news channel at 7 o'clock while people are going to work listening to this.
Defeat for the government's central policy on Tuesday would be historic. It would not only signal the failure of Theresa May's premiership, but the failure of the Conservative Party as a party of government.
We're in a stronger position than our detractors suggest. And that's one reason I will vote against the government's withdrawal agreement. Because simply put, it's a bad deal and Britain can do better.
The only ways to guarantee we do not leave without a deal are to abandon Brexit, betraying the vote of the British people, or to leave with a deal. You can take no deal off the table by voting for that deal.
We live in interesting times. Shadow Brexit Secretary Sir Keir Starmer joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Keir Starmer. And I never thought I'd ever have anything in common with Keir Starmer.
Morning.
Morning.
Are you a Game of Thrones fan?
I am a fan, but whether that's really what we need today, I don't know.
Brilliant. Whether that's what we need or not today, I don't know. Starmer could hear that that bollocks going on before he was introduced. That's the BBC today, you see. Game of Thrones. Really? Entertainment, soap opera, dragging you in. Get the popcorn. It's going to be great later on. It's entertainment. The BBC is supposed to be reporting on democracy being subverted. Not that we have any or ever have had. They should be digging down into why the 52% who voted to leave the European Union are not going to get that. Instead, they are staging a theatrical production to drag people into the drama, to invest you in the drama. Grab the popcorn. This is brilliant, isn't it? It's going to be brilliant later. Yeah. That's your media. Poor old Jacob Rees-Mogg was on ITV this morning with Susanna and Piers. Good morning, Britain, I think it's called. He's bewildered, his poor old terminological inexactitude, darling. He's still making the case, though, that we didn't vote for a deal. He's still making that case, to be fair to him, that we didn't vote for a deal. We voted to leave. Jacob Rees-Mogg.
They voted to leave the European Union. And that leaving the European Union opens up all those things. Control of fish, getting out of the European Court of Justice's jurisdiction, not paying all the money. All that is leaving. And what many people have said to me over the last month or so is that they didn't vote for a deal, they voted for leave. And the problem with the House of Commons is about three quarters of members of the House of Commons voted to remain. And therefore you've got a Remainer House of Commons trying to implement a leave that it doesn't want. And that's why you've got no agreement on the deal. From a Leaver point of view, it's very straightforward. We leave, and a deal is secondary to the issue of leaving.
Yeah. Doing a deal is incompatible with leaving. You can't do a deal and then leave. It's an oxymoron. And apart from Mogg and yours truly, nobody in the media has picked up on this fallacy. Doing a deal is not leaving. You don't leave the gym. I know I've said this before. You don't leave, walk away from a subscription to a newspaper and do a deal with them. Do a deal with you. No, I don't want your newspaper anymore. I'm fed up your gym. I'm not going to do a deal with you. You leave. You can't do a deal and leave. Doing a deal is staying in some form. It's accepting European Union jurisdiction over aspects of your society, of your governance. It's as simple as that. How can people not get their thick heads around that? People didn't vote for a deal, as he said a couple of minutes ago. They voted to leave. Leave with no deal, says Jacob Rees-Mogg. Leave with no deal. Don't put tariffs on EU goods. They will not do it to us, Mogg said this morning.
There is no reason for the British to put any obstacles to imports from the European Union when we leave. None at all. No tariffs, no non-tariff barriers. Indeed, it's an opportunity to reduce tariffs and tariff barriers against the rest of the world, cutting the cost of imports from the rest of the world, which are very often more competitive than those coming from the European Union. So it's a really exciting opportunity for us. And you're assuming, if I may say so, that the government would decide to punish the UK for leaving. Why would any government do that?
If no deal is such a brilliant opportunity, why isn't it something that the Prime Minister grasps with both hands?
Well, that's what Mr. Morgan was saying a moment ago, that the Prime Minister is a Remainer who wants to keep us close to the European Union, and that runs throughout the deal.
Couldn't be any simpler. It's the Parliament full of Remainers who have no intentions of implementing the will of the people. All right, OK. It is 17, it's 18 minutes past the hour, by the way. This is the Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, triggerwarning.tv, TuneIn Radio, and richieallen.co.uk. Always good to be with you. You can tweet the programme. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Love to hear your tweets. Love to see your tweets, even. Don't go anywhere. Jim Fetzer, live from Madison, Wisconsin, talking about Sandy Hook and the lawsuits after this from Queen. Welcome to the Richie Allen Show. Right, it's 20 minutes past the hour. That's Queen, and I Want to Break Free on your Richie Allen Show. Welcome back. As I mentioned, it's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. I know I've said that a few times. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. That's the Twitter handle. I'm sure you'll have an opinion on this next segment. Don't forget, coming up a bit later on in the programme, the Irish journalist Gerard O'Colman will join me live from Paris. A lot to talk about with Gerard in the second hour of the show. Before we welcome Jim back to the show, let me just read you a couple of bits and pieces from the news in the last couple of days and in the last couple of weeks. This from, I think it could be the LA Times, it might be the New York Times. Mark Zuckerberg to hold public debates on future of technology. This is the Facebook founder. And he has announced that he will hold public debates to talk about how the technology is being used. And according to, again, I'm not sure if it's the Times in New York or Los Angeles, but it's one of them. One of the papers is saying that potential guests to debate Facebook and to debate technology include Lenny Posner and Veronique Della Rocca, parents of victims of the Sandy Hook shooting. It's expected that Zuckerberg will use the debates as an opportunity to address issues beyond the data scandal, diving into the spreading of fake news and radical conspiracy theories. Lenny Posner and Della Rocca have long advocated against outlets that have said the Sandy Hook shooting was a hoax. The parents have been critical of how Facebook allows groups to operate against the parents of the victims, despite the gravity of the issue. Now, my first guest is a friend of mine, and he is a friend of mine, and he's been coming on this programme for many years. I call him a doyen of critical thinking. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Madison, Wisconsin. He's an author. He's a former Marine Corps officer. You can find his books at moonrockbooks.com. And we learned just before Christmas that he is the latest person to be sued. Not just Jim, but also Mike Palachek. They co-wrote the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. And Lenny Posner, whose son Noah, was among 26 people shot to death on December 14th, 2012. That's the story that we were told, right? He is suing Jim Fetzer and Mike Palachek for harassment. And I want to welcome back to the programme my old friend Jim Fetzer. Jim, thanks for coming on the programme. Firstly, has your lawyer, Jim, okayed you to speak to the media? Your lawyer doesn't mind or have any issue with you speaking about it today?
Well, Richie, at this point in time, I am pro se representing myself, even though I'm well aware of the saying that a plaintiff who represents himself as a fool for a client. The attorneys in Wisconsin are very skitterish about being involved with Sandy Hook because of the public impression that it was a real bona fide event, in spite of the massive evidence we have that it was a two-day FEMA exercise involving children, where we discovered the manual for the event, in which I included in the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook as Appendix A, which, as you know, Richie, was banned by Amazon.com less than a month after it went on sale, and it sold nearly 500 copies, even though it has 13 contributors, including six current or retired PhD professors, which make our finding that the school had been closed by 2008, that there were no students there, and that it was a FEMA exercise to promote gun control, highly unlikely to be mistaken.
I'm going to agree with one thing I've always agreed with. You see, it's difficult for me. With the absence of the other side, I'm going to be 100% honest. Some of the questions that you've raised about this shooting, which was given worldwide media coverage for days and weeks and even months after the event, and I've always believed in your sincerity. I said at the beginning of the programme, and I say it now, I know from knowing you since back in 2009 that you're a sincere man, that when you publish, when you make a claim, you believe it. Now, that doesn't compute for some people because they don't understand it. I'm never worried about whether somebody is right or whether they're wrong. All I'm interested in is their sincerity as, you know, as a radio producer and presenter, as a radio publisher. I just want to know that the person speaking to me is genuinely sincere in that what they're in what they are saying. I've always believed in your sincerity, and I've been perplexed by some of the evidence you've put forward, some of the questions asked, and also some of the questions put forward by other people who are not here today. Some of those people have been sued as well. But I'm going to say this, and it's not in any way having a dig at you in any way, shape or form at all. I believe Lenny Posner. I don't believe that Lenny Posner is lying. And what I want to ask you is, are the serious questions you're asking about the event and how it happened and all the anomalies, and I agree with you, they're anomalous, and I've tried to get comment from the other side on this programme when I was interviewing Wolfgang 3.5, 4, 5 years ago when I had you on, and they refused to come on. Despite the assurances they'd be treated respectfully, nobody ever came on from the other side of it. Is it incompatible? I don't think it is incompatible that something very wrong happened that day. But also, Jim, some of these people, their children died. I can't not. It's not because I don't want to believe them. To me, sincerity shines out of some of these people. Not all of them. And I want to talk about one particular parent that I've never been happy with. One parent who made a video who was laughing before a press conference. We can talk about that later on. But is it incompatible, Jim? You know, the serious problems with the official story. But also, it's plausible to me that some children died, Jim. I think Lenny Posner is sincere. Over to you.
Well, Richie, if you think Lenny Posner is sincere, then you've been played. Lenny Posner isn't even a real person. That's a fictitious name he has used. We have been able to establish that the son he claims to have died at Sandy Hook, Noah Posner, was actually himself a fiction made up out of photographs of the person supposed to be his older stepbrother, Michael Vabner. We have established this in spades. Richie, if anyone wants to go and look at the evidence about Sandy Hook, including our proof that Noah Posner was a fiction made up out of photographs of Michael Vabner when he was a child, check out on BitChute a Sandy Hook update, Tracy Loses, Wolfgang Wins, The Deep State Strikes Back, where I lay it out. We have been able to establish, Richie, on very strong evidence that the real name of Lenny Posner is Reuben Vabner, that the reason we have so many photographs of the guy who calls himself Lenny Posner with a person who's known to us as Noah Posner, when Noah Posner turns out to be Michael Vabner as a child, is because Lenny Posner is himself using a fictitious name. He actually is the father of Michael Vabner and posing as Lenny Posner, but his real name is Reuben Vabner.
You know, I read the book because you made it available to me, and the hypothesis you just outlined there is very, very interesting. It's intriguing. But I'm gonna say it to you, again, with the utmost sincerity, as interesting as it is, and much as I'd be, you know, with the resources and with the ability and with the time to properly get into that, for me, it's not 100% conclusive, Jim. It's not. I don't think it is. I'm not saying you're wrong and I'm looking at it and I'm doing you down here. I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's an interesting hypothesis. On the other side of it, I have this man who says, and I've seen the messages that he's been sent on, not recently, obviously, because I don't think he's on social media, But messages from people threatening to kill him, saying you're a big hoaxer, you're a big faker, yeah. Your son never died. This guy has gone in basically into hiding because there are people out there. Now, I would never, even if you were wrong, Jim, I would never blame that on you. That's intellectually redundant. I wouldn't do that. You're entitled to ask questions. There's no doubt about that. And that's what you're doing in your books. But people have gone after this guy, threatening to kill him and threatening to expose him. Can I just play, let me play a 45-second clip of the most recent interview that Lenny Posner did with US television. It's a very short clip, Jim. I think he did this with CNN. You'll be able to hear this loud and clear. This is Lenny Posner, the father of Noah Posner. I'm not going to say allegedly all the time. He's the father of Noah Posner. And here he is speaking to CNN, I believe, and I believe it's about 3 or 4 months. It might even be 6 months old. Have a listen.
You don't like to reveal your location or appear on camera because of the amount of threats that you've received, in large part from people who incredibly have been led to believe that Sandy Hook, that the shooting was a hoax. I mean, this must be unfathomable to you and your family, and I'm so sorry. So can you please tell our audience about that if you can?
Well, I know for people, it's hard to imagine that that people think this way, that they have this type of worldview. I'm quite accustomed to it after years of being exposed to it and having to read comments that people post on my social media pages, making accusations and insulting me, the memory of my murdered son. So this is what I have to deal with.
That was Lenny Posner, who was speaking on CNN some months ago. And Jim, these television programs have presented people who claim to be neighbours and friends of the Posners and people who've known Lenny Posner. I know that Megyn Kelly went to see the man and other journalists. I'm not declaring Megyn Kelly to be, a stand-up journalist, but a lot of people in the media went to meet the man and spoke with him, not just him, but other family members, and came back and said, you know, these people are genuine and they're absolutely bewildered that they're being told your kids didn't die and none of this ever happened.
Well, you're not looking at all the evidence. Frankly, I believe those allegations of threats and so forth are fabrications, just as a death certificate for Noah Posner is a fabrication. We have so much evidence that it was a FEMA drill, including the manual. We had participants who became confused about the date and put up donation websites on the 13th, the day before the event would take place. Even Adam Lanza, the alleged shooter, was recorded initially in the Social Security death index as having died on the 13th,
yeah,
which makes his feat in shooting 20 children and 6 adults the following day all the more remarkable.
This is why I'm perplexed, Jim. This is why I'm perplexed, because I read the book. I was fascinated by the book. I was intrigued by the book. I cross-referenced as much as I could from the book while I was reading it, because we interviewed about the book when the book initially came out. And I can't deny that there's a lot of very, very uncomfortable questions that need to be asked about this. I wouldn't deny it, of course. But well, I believe if you're right, Jim, I believe they still would have killed people, Jim. They have to sell something like that to the public. They often kill people and murder people. And what a tragedy it is if as I believe, that children were killed, some children were killed, and their parents are being targeted now, not by you necessarily, but by others who are saying you're all a bunch of liars, when in fact the truth is there was some sort of very unsettling false flag event going on that day, but also, you know, to substantiate that or to sell that, children were killed. I've listened to all the Posner audio and tapes that I possibly can, and to me it just... Jim, it's just my opinion. I'm not saying I'm right. To me, sincerity, I get the guy. I think there's the guy who's grieving for his son. Over to you.
Well, you know, as George Burns once observed long ago, if you can fake sincerity in Hollywood, you've got it made. This guy is a good actor, but listen to this. Tony Mead has discovered that Leonard Posner has 23 websites he uses to attack those who are doing research on Sandy Hook. If any children had died, it would be common for them to file a wrongful death lawsuit against the school system for not providing sufficient security. That did not happen.
But they might have been assured, Jim, hang on, they might have been assured, the families, that they will be taken care of. That's a strong possibility. You know, if it did happen and the children were killed, the families might have already come to some non-disclosure agreement with, you know, the people responsible for the school. No?
Richie, Lenny brought a lawsuit for defamation against Wolfgang Halbig before he brought this lawsuit for defamation against me. He never appeared in court. He sent in an attorney who was clearly incompetent. When the judge became impatient with a non-response to discovery, he granted Wolfgang the right to do a video deposition of Lenny Posner, at which point he withdrew the lawsuit. When Showtime program Darknet came to do a special, which is a program devoted to the internet, they have one clear-cut positive use of the internet, one clear-cut negative use of the internet, and then one controversial case. They did a program about Sandy Hook. They interviewed me here in my home for 4 hours. They interviewed Lenny Posner. When you see my face in that video, it's better defined and more precise than any other video I've ever seen in which I appeared, and there have been hundreds and hundreds. But Lenny refused to allow his face to be shown. He told them it was because he didn't want it to appear on the internet and be a subject to ridicule. But that's just a storyline. That's an apology because he doesn't want it to appear, I'm convinced, that someone might look and that say, I know that guy. That's Reuben Vabner. He doesn't want to be outed.
Yeah, and of course he's not here, right? And he might say, in the unlikely event he's listening to this, but maybe he is. Well, I'm sure he is. I mean, we did publicise it. And obviously, if he's serious about taking a case against you, I'm sure either Lenny, Mr. Posner will call him, or his representatives might very well be listening to this. If they are, I'd love to hear from them, you know, for a bit of balance. But Lenny Posner might say, Jim, he might say, I'm not going out in public. I'm not doing any of this videotaping because of the lunatics that exist in this world who are not just happy to watch a YouTube presentation or read a book. They have to take matters into their own hands. I want to give you an example of that. I know I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. There was a ridiculous hoax perpetrated on the independent media in the UK several years ago. It was about satanic sex abuse cult operating in Hampstead. Now, first and foremost, let me qualify what I'm going to say. Satanic ritual abuse is real. I've interviewed victims of it, and it's genuine, and it does happen. But the Hampstead thing was ridiculous. And the people who pushed it, the truthers who pushed it on the south coast of this country, were morons. And they pushed it, despite there was no evidence whatsoever to support it. What ended up happening, the point I'm trying to make is, Jim, and again, I don't blame the truthers for this either. I don't blame the truthers for this, moronic as they are. You know what happened, Jim? People started going to Hampstead and pointing at people in the street and calling them baby murderers. I mean, Jesus Christ, Jim, can you imagine? Again, I don't want to sound like I'm having a go at you because it's got nothing to do with you. If I'm Lenny Posner, I'm not going on camera because all I'm going to have then is people putting that image all over the place. You know, go and find Lenny Posner, call him a liar, call... tell him that his child never died. So in the absence of Lenny Posner, he would probably say, I don't want to be on camera. I want to get on with the rest of my life. Although you could say, well, if he does want to get on with the rest of his life, why is he suing me? But anyway, back to you, Jim.
Well, Richie, look, I'm not some kind of nut. I'm a former Marine Corps officer.
I know you're not.
I have a 35-year career in as a university professor offering principally courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. I've published 24 academic works. I've received a lot of accolades. I've held several distinguished professorships. My title now as a retired professor is Distinguished McKnight University Professor Emeritus from the University of Minnesota on the Duluth campus. I published over a dozen books in conspiracy research, all of which is collaborative, where I bring together the best experts on different cases. I have now 4 books on JFK. many of which are regarded as the best books ever published on the assassination because they approach it scientifically, working from the medical evidence out, sorting out the difference between the authentic and the inauthentic evidence. I've applied those same techniques to Sandy Hook, to the Boston bombing, to Orlando and Dallas, to Charlottesville. Anyone who wants to see the results of this research, which exposes a series of fraudulent events perpetrated by the government, in particular by the Democratic Party, to promote its gun control agenda, just go to moonrockbooks.com and check them out. We have a dozen books there. Richie, I would never make an allegation about anything that I could not prove, and I'm most certainly not making these allegations absent proof. I can prove everything I say.
I would never accuse you of claiming something to be true that you didn't believe, number one, to be true, and number two, that you didn't believe you could prove. I made that clear from the get-go. Your credentials are impeccable. I find you a thoroughly decent man who's motivated by decency. I really believe that. And I've said that since day one. You know, you're an intellectual heavyweight, Jim. If I was Lenny Posner's lawyer, you know what I would say to you? I would say, I'll tell you what, Mr. Fetzer, you're a very smart man. We all know that. And your research in recent years has taken you down rabbit holes where you believe that there is a very deep, rotten underbelly in society, a kind of a deep state, a kind of a hidden hand, and that they are manipulating events all the time. Mr. Fetzer, we know this because your books deal with these subjects. Now, Mr. Fetzer, I would say, if I was Lenny Posner's lawyer, isn't it true that when something happens like a shooting at Sandy Hook, Connecticut, isn't it true that your big old brain gets to work and before anything happens, you suspect foul play, you suspect a drill, or you suspect government interference? Go ahead.
Well, that's a misdescription and a failure to understand the stages of scientific reasoning. In the beginning, we begin with puzzlement, Richie. That's the very first stage. Something doesn't fit into our background knowledge or anomalies, inconsistencies. Sandy Hook abounds with them, including, for example, the presence of a sign, everyone must check in, porta potties in place. We had pizza and bottled water available at the firehouse. We had many with name tags on lanyards. We had children, parents bringing children to the scene where no parent would bring their child to the scene of a child shooting massacre. There was no surge of EMTs into the building, no string of ambulances to rush their little bodies off to hospitals where they could be declared to be dead or alive. No medevac helicopter was called. No bodies were placed on the triage tarps. It even turns out, by the way, that Sandy Hook Elementary School was not compliant with the requirements for Americans with disabilities, which required a blue and white signage for handicapped parking, blue and white parking. It's not there. This means the school could not have even been legally open on 14 December 2012. The second stage of scientific reasoning is speculation. What are the alternative possible explanations that might account for this phenomenon? We're here confronted with two, basically, namely that it was real. Some nut job went crazy, went to the elementary school, shot up 20 kids and six adults, versus that it was an illusion, that it was a FEMA drill. The third, and when you get into speculation, you have to consider the full range of alternatives. This is where Alex Jones has been quite valuable because he's been provoking us into think about alternatives with regard to a host of controversial events. But the third stage is crucial. That's the adaptation of the hypotheses to the evidence. Which hypothesis, if it were true, would confer the highest probability on the available evidence? When you compare the hypothesis that it was real with the evidence I just enumerated, it has a virtually zero probability. When you compare the hypothesis that it was a FEMA drill, that it was an illusion, however, it has a very high probability. In fact, we know, and it states right in the FEMA manual, that everyone must check in with a controller when they arrive on the scene, which explains the sign. It's standard for FEMA drills to provide restrooms and refreshments, which accounts for the porta potties and the bottled water and pizza. They identify the players using color-coded name tags on lanyards, it all fits. All the evidence we had broadcast from Sandy Hook, from Newtown that day,
it's
supports
bizarre,
the hypothesis it was a deception
it's bizarre.
For political purposes, Richie.
It's bizarre. And like I said at the outset of this conversation, it's utterly bizarre. I'm not going to dispute any of that because I read the book and I cross-referenced it. And I know that some of my listeners are going to be screaming at their radios, calling me a coward, something I've never been in my life and never will be. And they'll say, you're sitting on the fence, Richie. I'm not. I just can't accept for a fact, for 100%, that this is not, that your hypothesis that this thing was staged to bring about, a third outcome, to bring about an outcome. I can go along with that, but I don't think it's incompatible with real people losing their lives. I just want to make one point just before you come back in, Jim.
Richie, there's no evidence that any child lost their life. In fact, if you even look at the final report on Sandy Hook by Danbury State's attorney, Stephen Sedensky, he can't even connect the alleged shooter, Adam Lanza, with the victims or the weapons he's supposed to have used.
Let me back in for a minute.
Lanza with his mother's death because a .22 caliber rifle with which he's alleged to have shot her.
It's a whole other story,
isn't
it?
Fingerprints.
Yeah, we
he
could spend. Sorry,
Adam,
Jim.
With the weapon he's supposed to have used to shoot the kids, because although they recovered 150 plus slugs, they could not identify any of those slugs as having come from the weapon he's purported to have used. It's a total forensic failure.
Right, hang on a second. Let me back in. The story of Lanza shooting his mother on its own, you could dedicate a program to it. Look, I'm not arguing with you that this wasn't investigated properly, that it is bizarre, that the list of anomalies you put out there a second ago are genuine. You've not invented them. I know this. But there were a lot of people. I watched this for days on Fox, CNN, as much as I could get here in the UK. I watched it on Sky News. And you're seeing all these different people who saw the bodies, all these people who claimed that they saw the bodies or dealt with the bodies. Now, let me just say one thing before you come back in. Part of the lawsuit that Lenny Posner has filed against you and others, one of the things that he did was he attached young Noah's death certificate to the lawsuit, but they did redact Posner's address because, again, he expresses concerns that he's going to be attacked if his address is out there. So there is a death certificate.
Well, of course there's a death certificate, but it's different than the death certificate that Lenny Posner gave to Kelly Watt when, during 100 hours of conversation between them, she explained to Lenny she didn't believe a word he said, didn't believe he had a son, didn't believe he died at Sandy Hook. Lenny sent her a copy of a death certificate that turns out to be a fabrication. It has no file number. It has a wrong estimated time of death at 11 a.m. when the shooting, according to the official account, took place between 9:35 and 9:45. It has the wrong texture. The bottom texture, two-thirds or three-quarters of it, is very dark. The top is very light. It's a combination of the bottom of a real death certificate with the top of a fake. It has all kinds of minute discrepancies in the font and the size of the type, Richie. It was created using multiple different fonts, which is absurd. You create a document, you do it with one typewriter at one time. This was done over a long period of time. Not only that, but the official state-supported death certificate has changes to the address that were initiated by the father, which is absurd. The decedent has not changed his address after he died, and obviously the death certificate should have the address of the decedent. Not only that, but the official death certificate they release is missing the bottom portion on the death certificate that Lenny sent to Kelly, which identifies him as a student, but doesn't specify the grade and marks out his social security number, which is frankly absurd. This fellow is dead. He's not going to use his social security number. But I'm telling you, there's a mountain of proof here. And if anyone wants to go through my initial answer, they can find it on my blog at jamesfetzer.org under the title Sandy Hook Posner versus Fetzer Lawsuit for Dummies, where I spell out the core of the case. which boils down to this. The plaintiff maintains that the state of Connecticut has certified a death certificate, which according to the plaintiff is in all material respects the same as the death certificate that the plaintiff gave to Kelly Watt, and therefore it must be authentic. The defendant replies, since we have proven that the death certificate that Lenny Posner gave to Kelly Watt is a fabrication on the basis of the reasons I just enumerated and more, if it's the same as a certified certificate from the state, then the state has certified a fake death certificate. And that makes perfect sense, Richie, because the state was deeply involved. We have 50 photographs showing them furnishing an empty house to serve as the Adam Lanza residence in Chapter 7. We have 50 more photographs of them.
Why were they so sloppy, Jim? Hang on now. This is not a monologue, my old friend, my valued friend, by the way. This is not a monologue. Why were they so sloppy? And I want to play another little bit of audio in a second. We've got till the top of the hour. We've got 10 more minutes on this. Why were they so sloppy? I can't figure this out, Jim. I mean, you would have thought these people would have been, by the way, I'm speaking as a critic listening to this, who's criticising Jim Fetzer. Why were they so sloppy? How do we get photographs of them setting up the domestic arrangement or the domestic situation of Adam Lanza? How do those photographs end up in your hands?
Well, because the state police were running the scene behind the public facade. These photographs were taken by the state police. They're absolutely stunning. The one of the Nancy Lanza bedroom, for example, you can see some red stuff on the bed, but it's not blood. I think it might be raspberry jam. Kelly Watt, with her keen eye, happens to have her own commercial and home cleaning service and noticed a blue moving pad beneath the leg of the bed that in their haste they'd forgotten to remove. In the 50 photographs they have from refurbishing the school, there's a classic where the SWAT team vehicle is already present before the event has taken place. You can tell that because above the roof, there's a string of four windows in classroom 10 that are undamaged. After the event, they'd be shot out. I include the windows before and after in the book so you can tell the difference. You come down the flagpole and there's a familiar figure with his arms folded leaning against the wall. None other than Wayne Carver, the medical examiner, awaiting the arrival of his portable mortuary tent. There's crime scene tape up for a crime that is yet to be committed. We initially thought this was taken the morning of the 14th, but actually it turns out to have been taken the evening of the 13th when they were setting up to present this drill as a live event, as a child massacre the following day.
The book, I read the book. Look, it's moonrockbooks.com. I want to play a bit of audio before we run out of time. And I will give you the last word before we hit the top of the hour. Old friend of mine, Jim Fetzer, is live on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. Lenny Posner, the father of Noah Posner, who we were told, we have been told, was murdered at the Sandy Hook school in Connecticut, of course, back in December of 2012. Along with 26 other people, or including, he was one of 26 people, that's what we were told. He's sued a number of people and has filed suit against Jim Fetzer and Jim's co-author, Mike Palachek. I want to play you a little bit of audio. And I'm not being obstinate, I'm not being stubborn, I'm not displaying cognitive dissonance. I'm still not convinced that a staged event is incompatible with real people being killed. But anyway, look, I want to play this clip from Neil Heslin. I'll do it very quickly, Jim. This is Neil Heslin, and he's speaking with Megyn Kelly. Neil's child was shot, Neil says, on the day, and he's talking again about the conspiracy theories around Sandy Hook. This is Neil Heslin.
Well, it's accountability and responsibility. It's going on for 4.5 years, the lies, the trauma that he imposes, the pain and suffering with the lies he peddles. And, you know, to say that Sandy Hook was a hoax and it never happened, it's an outright lie. It's a total disrespect to myself, my son, the individuals who lost their lives that day, But it extends so much further than that. It's a disrespect to the community and the law enforcement, the first responders. It's not right. And he needs to, it needs to stop.
Neil Heslin was talking about Alex Jones there. I mean, Jim, they're talking on national television, these people. If they're actors, surely they're going to be outed as such. Surely people are going to point at them and say, hang on a second, I know this guy. He used to be this man or he used to be that man. I mean, it's incredibly bold, if you're right, ultimately, that these are all part of a production crew. It's an incredibly brazen thing to do, to go on national television and claim your son was murdered, if that, you know, if that isn't true. Back to you, Jim.
It was very cleverly contrived to have maximal emotional impact. Neil Heslin is a part of the problem. When he testified to Congress, he brought in a huge photograph of him with his son, which was supposed to be, you know, like only six years previous, because he was a first grader, right? But it turns out Neil Heslin looks like he's at least 16 years older. And this is part of the deception. We noticed from the beginning that the children, the clothing the children were shown wearing in the photographs, that they weren't allowed to see the bodies because Wayne Carver said it was easier to identify them on photographs. And we've figured out why, because they only existed as photographs. The average age of the parents of the Sandy Hook kids is 36. Nationwide, it's only 26. Carl Herman has calculated the improbability of those parents averaging 36, and it's infinitesimal. It did not happen. Meanwhile, they made out like bandits. Sympathetic but gullible Americans contributed between $27 and $130 million, divided between the 26 surviving families, Richie. They pocketed over $1 million from pretending to have children who died at Sandy Hook. He has filed a lawsuit against me. I welcome the lawsuit. I want a formal resolution within a court of law, and I'm pursuing it very aggressively. Mark my words, I'm very glad they brought this suit.
That's as good a place, as good a place as any to leave it, Jim. I'm not convinced that people didn't die there. I'm not convinced that Lenny Posner is lying and some of these people are lying. I mean, I did say there was one parent who did a media appearance. He walked out of a building, he was laughing and joking, and then he seemed to compose himself and tear up and give a statement. I think the man's name might be Parker. I found
Robbie Parker, Richie.
I found it strange, Jim, you know, to say the least. But, and I'm not being cowardly, I'm not covering my arse. I just listen to Lenny Posner and I think, Jesus, there's the guy who sounds like he's broken, you know, and others. And to me, the two scenarios can exist in you know, side by side, that a sinister cartel of dark actors staged this event, but at the same time, they offed some innocent children. I can see how that's possible. I have the utmost respect for you. I promised you the final word. I said you finished it really well, but I am going to give you the last word. We've got 35 seconds. I wish you well with it. Go ahead, Jim.
It was sloppy because this was first of what would become a whole series of these orchestrated events, all of which are political theater. If you study the case and you want to support my efforts to oppose the deep state and reveal the truth about these fabricated events, go to moonrockbooks.com. And if you're so inclined, make a donation, large or small. We appreciate your efforts. We're seeking to minimize the legal costs, but discovery can be expensive. I'm going to depose these parties, including Lenny Posner, and I would welcome any support any of your listeners can provide for this most worthy effort.
Well, next week, Jim, and if I don't do it, remind me, next week I'll send you $50, my old friend. If you don't see it coming in, remind me. I do have a terrible memory. And do remind me, but I'll put a reminder on the computer. I'll send you $50. I believe you've always been motivated by decency and sincerity. And because of that, a part of me, you know, a good part of me wants you to be absolutely right. The other part of me hates the thought of you being wrong about the children anyway, because, you know, if you are, well, then you have parents then who are dealing with bereavement and who are bewildered. But look, Mate, I wish you the best with it. I know you'll be back on this program again anyway. It's moonrockbooks.com, folks, as Jim said. Good luck and keep us updated on it, Jim, as it proceeds, mate. Thanks for coming on and explaining it tonight to us.
Thank you, Richie. I think you're the best talk show host in the world. I'm very honored to be on with you again.
You're a gentleman. Thanks for saying that, Jim. Jim Fetzer, former Marine Corps officer, nearly four decades, or well, in fact, four decades of teaching at university level, Professor Emeritus, Critical Thinking, University of Madison, Wisconsin, written fantastic books on JFK and many other subjects. Passionately believes in what he's saying, Jim. I don't believe for a minute that what he has done, what he has written, was designed to hurt anyone. He's motivated by one thing and one thing only, getting to the truth of the matter. That was Jim Fetzer live on The Richie Allen Show. It's approaching the top of the hour. We're approaching 6 p.m. UK time, the 9th, the 15th even, of January 2019. Garrodo Colmón will join the programme in a few minutes' time. We will change direction. We'll talk about the Gilets Jaunes protests, which began in Paris but seem to have morphed or found their way or moved or expanded to other parts of the world. We'll talk about that. I know Garrod is very interested in what's happening with the withdrawal bill and a vote in Parliament. We'll talk about that as well. Is the far right on the rise in Europe? We'll ask Garrod about that. He's a great guy. We've got him for about a half an hour. So I think the smart thing to do is first of all to take some music, then come back, read some of your comments, and then get Garrod on. How about that? This is Marvin Gaye and a song called What's Going on the Richie Allen Show. A minute past six it is now. Europe's most listened to independent radio show. Thanks for being with me. Love this tune. Marvin Gaye, What's Going on the Richie Allen Show. Tuesday's programme. Let me tell you very briefly about tomorrow's programme. Gerald Celente joins the programme. Looking forward to that. I can't believe it's been about 7-8 months since Gerald was on the show. We'll have a look at the trends, predictions, the forecasts for 2019 with Gerald. And we will give him a bit of credit too for the things he predicted accurately back in 2018. I've also got an author called David Sedgwick on the programme tomorrow as well. He's written a book about brainwashing at the BBC. Yeah, it came out just before Christmas. Fascinating book. David Sedgwick, academic man, who's fired some broadsides at the BBC in a book about how the BBC brainwashes the public. He'll be on the show with me tomorrow as well. So interesting stuff this week on your Richie Allen Show. Approaching 5 minutes past the hour. The 15th of... Why do you keep telling us the time and the date, Richie? You see, it was drilled into me. It's one of those things you can't... I'd have to go to a hypnotherapist to stop it. Drilled into me. Time and date and weather. As a young presenter, as a young producer, drilled into me. Every few minutes, the time, the temperature, and the date. Just in case people are stupid, you know? As they're driving around in their cars. Yaw. As they're driving around in their cars. Right, let's get Garrod on the programme then. Live from Paris. Looking forward to this a lot. Top man is Garrod. And speaking of guests who've not been back on this programme for some time, it's been well over a year since Garrod was on the programme. He's a fascinating guy. And that's not in any way to patronise him. Very, very shrewd analyst. Always brilliantly briefed. Really, really smart man. Based in Paris these days. Political analyst. And often featured on RT and other more open-minded and more, I suppose, I would say ethical purveyors of broadcast journalism, talking about geopolitical issues and globalisation and much more besides. His website is garrodocolmón.org, and you can follow him on Twitter, thousands do, if you haven't followed him. It's at Broadford Soviet on Twitter. Delighted to welcome him back to the show. We've got him for about a half an hour, so let's crack on. Garrod, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good evening, Richie. Nice to be back.
That's great to have you on. I know it's a bit late to be saying this, but Happy New Year to you and the wife, and you got a young child there, of course, and
likewise to you, Richie, and your family.
Well, thanks very much. Let's jump straight into what's been happening in Paris. The future, Mrs. Allen. It'll happen someday. Went to see family just before Christmas. She's originally from Nancy, so she spent a few hours in Paris wandering around before getting the train up to, or across, I should say, to Nancy, and was watching this with great interest, these protesters and these yellow jackets. And of course, it's been all over the news for the last few weeks. Nobody better placed than you to talk about this. How did it start? Why did it start? What's going on with it? Why has it spread?
Well, the initial movement is basically kind of sprung out of the unpopular policies of the Macron administration, who raised the tax on diesel in order to comply with the so-called energy transition program that the government is pushing, which is basically reducing the so-called carbon emissions and going towards what I refer to as a green regime, which is essentially taxing carbon emissions. Nobody knows, of course, where the taxes go, other than the global institutions. The global institutions, according to the Paris Climate Accord. So the workers were basically paying for the energy transition. That's what the rebellion was about. And the yellow vests are vests that you're required to carry in your car in France. And so it became, the initial reaction of the people, and mostly working people, working class people, was, that this is a state of emergency. So because of the price of living, the astronomical cost of living, the price of fuel going up obviously makes life much harder for working people, particularly in rural areas where they need to take their cars, they need to use the cars to get to work, long distances and so on. So people were going to be paying literally hundreds more in the month because of this. And for a lot of people, they just, like, there was no way they could manage that. So they put on the yellow vest, as in, in protest against that. So that's how the movement started. And that started on the 17th of November. So it's sort of, it's taken off since then. You've had, we're in the ninth week now, the ninth act of the protest movement. And it's going to go on, I think, this week. The country's insurrection, basically.
It's incredible to watch. It must be incredible being there. So somebody asked me to put to you, as an Irishman being there, and I know you've been in Paris for, some time. You're not newly arrived there. Is it true, this image we have of the French that we sometimes might aspire to, that when things get tough, they do take to the streets and they do stand up to what they disagree with in a way that maybe we don't do as much anymore?
I think that one thing I've noticed in the culture, and it's, again, I've been here 10 years now, and even when you speak the language, you kind of try to do, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. I'm one of those kind of people. I try to adapt as much to the country I'm in. And there are certain things still I just don't, you just don't get as an Irishman. First of all, we don't complain that much.
No.
When I'm driving, I'll just stop if somebody, I rarely hoot the horn. If somebody's crossing the road, I'll stop. And it's like, Irish people are very chilled out, and we don't like to complain. We're not very aggressive. I think that's a good thing. I mean, that's just our culture. Here, I mean, you make slightest error and people will be hooting the horn, and they are edgy, the French. That's just their culture. I think they're kind of perfectionist as a culture. And so I think that, the good aspect of that is that when they're getting ripped off, they kind of realize that quicker than, say, we would, because we, Irish people tend to be a bit more complacent. So I think that's one fundamental difference. They are edgy and they're fiery, and they do have a temper. And they will fly off the handle. So that collectively is also their strength, because when things get out of hand, like in this case where Macron is really, he's really pushing it. He wants to finance essentially global government, because that's what the COP21 Paris Climate Accord is. It's a blueprint for global government.
Absolutely.
And he wants to finance a global government by making ordinary French people you know, working people, lorry drivers, cab drivers, ordinary, you know, the everyday people pay for it. It's a disgrace. So, you know, you if you push those people too far, they will react in that way. And again, that's their strength as a people. We should be a bit more like that in Ireland, where we have politicians, you know, like the current government, openly attending secret meetings all over the world, getting caught doing it, getting filmed on camera, like Coveney coming out of the Bilderberg meeting, you know, admitting, yeah, we're just, you know, secretly meeting all these globalists, deciding the future of our country, and kind of, well, what are you going to do about it? You know, we should be demonstrating against them with the same kind of fury, I think.
Yeah, I was watching Garrod O'Colman is our guest, and Garrod is regularly featured on RT. It's where I first came across him a few years ago. I was watching an Irish Republican called Colm Lynock speaking about the European Union, and he aptly described our country. And I'm kind of proud of it. You know, I'm an Irish Republican, and I used to apologise for that many years ago. I don't anymore. You know, I'd love to see a united Ireland run by an Irish, you know, a real government, an Irish government elected, working in the interest of the Irish people. And it was very interesting watching Colm Lynock speaking on the Going Underground programme. And he said, we have politicians now in Ireland who openly admit that, you know, they totally understand and admit that there is no sovereignty whatsoever in the country. Not only that, but we're basically indentured labour for the European Union. And that's what we are. And we don't do we lament that and we talk about it, but we don't do anything about it. Now, what has Macron done? Has he opened Pandora's box by this COP21 thing? Because the protests movement, like, it might be initially about diesel and fuel and how that's going to affect the ordinary person. But then they start looking into everything else, immigration, how that's impacting the economy. Has he done that, opened the Pandora's box there?
He certainly has, because, you know, the I mean, this is a citizens' movement. It is decentralized. There isn't really a leadership. There are different currents within the movement. So Jacqueline Mouhot was one of the initial one of the activists whose video went viral at the start of the movement, and she, you know, she is basically trying to push the movement in the direction of compromise. She actually voted for Sarkozy, I think, a few years ago. She's by no means a dissident. I would be very wary of her, actually. I've seen her on television, and I've seen her, I've seen other yellow vests criticizing her as well on television, saying, you know, she doesn't represent the movement. So she seems to be some kind of infiltration. God only knows what her background is, but I know that she definitely is not representative of the base of the demonstrations, which is, again, people demonstrating against far more than just the fuel tax, but the lack of democracy, the lack of consultation with the people. So they have, you know, this, they're calling for popular referenda. The ability for the people themselves to propose a referendum. So if you get 700,000 signatures, that referendum then would be put to the people. So it's basically, they're looking for direct democracy.
What do you think of that, Garrod? What do you think of that as an idea?
I think it's a good idea, but, I'm not, how would you say, there's a lot of consultation going on. I think it's a start, right? But I think that the problem with that is that if I think the first thing is that people are informed. You know, people I've spoken to, activists I've spoken to, are well informed. They say the first thing they're trying to do is re-inform people. You know, that media is the problem here again, and it's like every issue, because, you know, if you spend all day discussing things that don't kind of hit the nail on the head, and you have a referendum about it, you're wasting time, you know. So it kind of depends on how you democratize the means of communication. That's the first thing. And I spoke to some you know, yellow vests on Saturday about that. And, you know, some were kind of the level of knowledge of globalization varies. So, you know, one woman told me, you know, the Rothschilds control everything. They run France. They run Europe. You know, she knew what she was talking about in terms of the media. Another man told me, you know, the media want a debate, but the debate is very limited. And so, you know, other people will say things like, you know, we want to stay in the European Union, but we want, you know, we want a social Europe. I guess it depends on what kind of media they're reading and what kind of, you know. So, yeah, it's certainly a start. But, you know, like everything, it would have to, I think the main what the movement, what I'm trying to say is that the movement needs leadership now. I don't believe in this kind of leaderless movement. It's okay for a while. It can put pressure. But you know,
is that why Occupy failed, Giroud?
You need someone who's also a leader and actually kind of knows what to do, you know, because you could spend all day standing around saying, oh, you know, I'd like this and I'd like that, and let's vote on this and let's vote on that. And you know, I don't, in a way, I see the problem in the world as just the problem of bad government, you know. It's like if there was a dictator running France, and I always say this, and he was really good and he had all the right policies, would anybody really care? You know, it's like, it's not actually our inability to vote on a daily basis that bothers us. It's our lives, not being able to take charge of our lives, you know. And I think that's kind of, so I guess democracy in the workplace or a say in our future, that's what people want, you know. They don't really care who sits in parliament, you know.
Was that a problem with the Occupy movement? You just describing the leaderless aspect of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing about the Occupy movement is, you know, again, the ideology of the Occupy movement, and you had a similar type of one here a couple of years ago called Nuit Debout, which is basically people up all night, was that they were, the kind of ideological current there was what the French call altermondialiste, you know, kind of the anti-globalization movement, which is sort of, you know, a leftist ecological. The French have that, you know, bien pensant, as the French say, well thinking, well meaning, but utterly ineffective, because a lot of those kind of groups are financed by the very people they claim to oppose, like George Soros, and you know, you have those human rights groups and all that kind of stuff, Democracy Now type media, all of that fake left wing ideological current is financed by finance capitalism, by people like George Soros and others. So it's, you know, and in a way, actually, there is a very good film by Steve Bannon on this, where he kind of points that out. And it's the reason why I've kind of, you know, I have a slightly more nuanced view of Trump and Bannon, because it's kind of the first time I've ever seen a U.S. administration with that kind of analysis, which is interesting. But so I don't really, you know, if it's Occupy Wall Street, forget it. It's going nowhere. That was designed to go nowhere. I mean, guys sitting outside, you know, in New York, in tents and sort of smoking pot, that's not really going to change the world, you know.
No, it's not, no. I want to remind our listeners where they can find Giroud. Is that GiroudoColmon.com? I'll tweet it out for the Philistines in the States listening to this who don't have any Gaeilge. It's GiroudoColmon.com, and it's at
.org.
Is that how I should say it? Is that right? Because I would always say Giroud, but it's not. You've corrected me.
GiroudoColmon.org.
All right, sorry, no, I thought I was saying Giroud wrong. GiroudoColmon.org. Sorry, Giroud, yeah, you gave me a fright there. I'm not mispronouncing Giroud, surely. GiroudColmon.org. I'll tweet a link to it. It's at Broadford Soviet on YouTube. Can I ask you for a quick answer to this one?
Yeah.
On Twitter, I should say, at Broadford Soviet on Twitter. Let me get it quick, because we've only got about 15 minutes left. You've got things to do.
Yeah.
So give us a quick answer on this. You mentioned the open democracies and these types of, you know, major manipulators in the world. What are the dangers that the Yellow Vest, and you kind of hinted at it a little bit, that the Yellow Vest, the Gilets Jaunes movement, could be ultimately co-opted by more nefarious kind of people?
Well, they would. I mean, you have people like Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who is the leader of the movement called La France Insoumise, which probably means France Unbowed. Unbowed is the usual translation of that movement that he's the leader of, that political party. And Mélenchon is, you know, he's a friend of Dassault. He's protected by the oligarchy. He always has been. And he is, you know, an extraordinarily manipulative politician. And he, you know, he is part of the problem. Not, he's in no way the solution. Jean-Luc Mélenchon is pro-war. He voted for the war in Libya. He actually suggested that the White Helmets, would you believe, the White Helmets, the notorious White Helmets, operating in Syria, and a cover organization, a front organization for Al Qaeda, again backed by Soros and the British government. He suggested that they should come in to rescue the yellow vests, would you believe?
Jesus,
I'm not joking. Yeah.
Wow.
So this is like this is, you know, one possible choice. This is a card the oligarchy could play, which would be Jean-Luc Mélenchon, play the left-wing card. The other one would be Marine Le Pen. In my opinion, she's a has-been. She was pathetic against Macron in the election. She just collapsed in the final debate. Everybody says that, and she just doesn't have it. And she, you know, I don't. She's not cultured enough to assume that kind of a position. The Le Pens are for me kind of a spent force, and it would be better that they just left the scene now. So I've spoken to a lot of people. About 60% of the people who are in the yellow vests are people, I think, who voted FN or would be a kind of that, you know, and that'd be like French working class people. Français de souche, as they say, that, you know, the white French or whatever you want to call them. That doesn't mean that it's only, the white French or the original French people, because you have a lot of Maghreb, Arabs there, Algerians. I've spoken to a lot of black people. But I'd say they would be definitely the majority, and they would be about more than 60% of the people there. But a lot of them I've spoken to, they don't want Marine Le Pen, they don't want Jean-Luc Mélenchon. So it's kind of wide open. It looks like that this will kind of morph into a movement of itself. Will it be co-opted by these people I've spoken about, fake left and so on? They're definitely trying. But the problem with them is that the discourse of the fake left is aimed at university people. It's a sort of middle-class university, and it's not the bread and butter working-class people. They don't buy any of this stuff. You know, you talk to any, and it doesn't matter whether it's the old French, if you like, or the new French, because the new French would be a lot your average Algerian shopkeeper or whatever. You know, a lot of them, they have the same views on globalist issues, you know. So I was in the taxi just coming back the other night from Press TV, and taxi driver was a black taxi driver. He was talking about Dieudonné, completely supports the yellow vests. The media are trying to push the race card here. They're trying to say that this is some kind of a racist movement and that they have some kind of a nefarious agenda. And they're trying to divide people. And there are various politicians situated who are pushing that line as well. I would see something like Mélenchon or that to be a kind of a possible choice of the oligarchy. But one thing for sure is that this is going to continue. It's going to be another act this week. And, people are talking about a revolution, that it's already a cultural revolution that's taking place. So the Macron regime is really in crisis. It's in trouble. Macron has just launched a national debate. But, of course, there's no debate about anything. You know, you're not allowed to talk about climate change, global warming. You're not allowed to talk about the migration crisis. You're not allowed to talk about the sexual revolutions happening in the schools and all this kind of stuff. You know, these are all the big issues. And I suppose, again, to come back to, direct democracy, and if 20 people get together and start talking about nothing all day long and start voting, it's pointless. But if they really you know, talk about the real issues, we could make some progress, you know. So that, but that does depend on how well informed they are, you know.
Of course it does. Garrod, I want to get into GarrodoColmon.org, folks, Broadford Soviet on Twitter. I want to stay with this theme for the time we have left, this theme of migration. The meaningful vote will take place in Westminster at some stage in the next couple of hours. It's widely expected that it'll be one of the heaviest defeats for 70 or 80 years for a sitting UK Prime Minister. I opened my show up many times to callers, and I had Skypes and calls coming in from not only all over the UK, but from all over the world, talking about Brexit and why we should leave the European Union. And they talked about jobs and manufacturing, and they talked about migration. Migration, you said, so you did a wonderful piece with Gemma O'Doherty a few weeks ago. I highly recommend.
Thanks.
No, it's really good. It's very, very educational. It's on Gemma's YouTube channel. Watch her chat with Garrod about a lot of different things.
She's getting censored now. I saw that,
yeah.
Her recent video was taken down.
And she was told that 3 months without, as far as I understand, I sent her a message today. I've not heard back from her yet, but I understand she's been told she can't live stream for 3 months, and they've said something about copyright, about a photograph that was in the background, and it's absolute nonsense. It's because she's asking, she's winding people up because she's having the sorts of discussions that we shouldn't be having on shows like this. However big an audience we might have, it's nothing compared to RTE or the BBC or ITV. These are the conversations they should be having, but they're not having them. But back to what you said to Jim, it was amazing. I was punching the air watching it. I was watching it live. I was absolutely delighted. You talked about how the concern about unskilled or semi-skilled migrants putting pressure on job seekers in working class communities, that was a genuine concern of the genuine left going way back. And it was amazing you saying that. Because a friend...
Go ahead, talk about that.
Yeah. Very important, this, because it's not a right-wing thing.
No, it's not. I mean, it's always been... Look, the reason why the FN became popular is because of the decline of the PCF, the French Communist Party, who normally would get the working class vote in France, at least a considerable part of it. And because they decline for ideological reasons, I mean, that's a globalist party now. They are completely in bed with the ruling class. They no longer have a class analysis, and they haven't for a very long time. It is a fact that in the 1960s, from the 1960s on, the French elite feared a communist revolution in France. And that is a fact. They feared a working class rebellion because of working class militancy. And one of the ways in which they dealt with that was to bring in foreign workers who would not have the same level of analysis, because the French Communist Party used to train people. I mean, they had a big building, and they would, you know, and whatever you say about Marxism, the Marxist analysis of class struggle is very relevant to the capitalist system. I mean, Marx was a student of capitalism, and, you know, you do get a handle on how capitalism works and what its problems are and why you're not getting a good wage. And so if you're trained in, you know, the basics of Marxism, you're going to be quite, an organized worker. You're going to want to join a union, and you're going to know what your rights are and so on. So in order to break working class militancy, the ruling elite started favoring immigration. And the PCF resisted it. Marie-Georges Marché was anti-immigration. The National Front line is essentially Georges Marché's line. And it was partly the result of the influence of Alain Soral, who was also PCF, also a Communist Party member, who is a French intellectual, who basically joined the National Front and basically tried to push them more in the left in terms of being more, have more of an emphasis on labor. And that's sort of how the National Front became a kind of almost like a mass party to a certain extent. Now, they, you know, go back to the 1980s, Jean-Marie Le Pen supported Reagan, supported neoliberalism. I've written about this before. It's by no means a coherent it was, it doesn't exist anymore now, but it was by no means a coherent response here or a coherent movement. But it did, the point I'm making is that criticism of the analysis of mass migration as a means through which the ruling class drives down the cost of labor, that has always been a standard Marxist analysis, particularly in France. So there's nothing, the way in which the PS, it was the PS that very much pushed that under Mitterrand. So what they did in order to basically stifle criticism of it was to say that people who criticized it were racist. So they started developing this so-called anti-racist politics. It's extremely toxic because the very same people who go into Africa, they'll overthrow or kill a progressive African leader. They'll bomb the country into smithereens, rape it and pillage it. Those people then get onto boats and come in here. We criticize that policy and we're the racists.
Absolutely. You know? We're seeing it in the Middle East.
And this is going on in Libya. And you see these guys, these little petty bourgeois leftists on the street with their no racism and, you know, refugees welcome and all that. Where were they during the bombing of Libya? Where were they during the bombing of Syria? Where were they when African countries have been invaded? They're never to be seen, and they're never interested. You know, those people make me sick, and they have a monopoly in the media. You know, they have their place, and they're the same here. You have Besancenot in France. He's the French version of
Owen Jones.
What's the guy in Ireland again called? Boyd Barrett. He's the French version of Boyd Barrett. And, you know, people are sucked into that. You know, there's a place for everything, I suppose. And fake leftist media is one to play the race card. It's so, you know, it's obviously the migration pact is the end of Europe, because Macron is talking about 200 million people from Africa. Of course, it's going to do two things. The regimes in Africa, and I cover that a lot and will be more extensively in the weeks to come, you know, they are being overthrown by globalist networks, particularly Soros finance networks. I've been saying this for years. They're all over Africa. They're like almost every state has them. It's a virus that's spreading in that continent. They use very legitimate concerns. People don't like their governments. They're probably corrupt. But what government isn't corrupt?
Yeah, absolutely.
There are disparities and so on and so forth. It's very easy to manipulate people in these countries when you're George Soros in particular and you've got billions at your disposal. So they're overthrowing governments in Africa. They're also siphoning off the intellectual elite of the continent. You know, that's a big problem in developing countries.
Huge problem,
A doctor from Nigeria can earn more in Ireland, and we need doctors in Ireland, you know, because our doctors are going to Australia, right?
Amazing.
So, you know, like this is a problem. All our elites are leaving as well because of poor wages in Ireland and in France, right? So the European countries, our elites go elsewhere, or, you know, talented people we need. African people of talent, well, they'll go to Europe. So basically you have this flow of people and nobody benefits other than the capitalists. You know, they're the people who benefit. And what it does then is you have a compliant population. So when you get hundreds of millions of people from Africa into Europe, those people depend on the goodwill of the state that's bringing them in. So they're slaves essentially, because, you know, the state will use them to get votes. And also there's a sort of a deal, which is to say, look, we brought you in here. We gave you, you know, refugee money. We put you up. We promoted you. We demoted our own people. Our own people hate us, right? They're the yellow vests. They hate our guts. But here's what we'll do. We'll protect you against them. You know,
right, yeah.
not that the native people of Europe want to attack these people, but that's what the media says about the native people, that they're horrible racist fascists.
The creation, you know, of vulnerable groups, more and more
exactly.
Vulnerable groups.
And
being
the
created,
more you do that, then the more, you know, the more you create a situation of possible civil war, because the indigenous people feel disenfranchised and resent the immigrants, of course, and the immigrants are going to feel, you know, that they are disenfranchised as well, which they are in many respects, because their countries have been, you know, mowed down by globalization for the last century, you know. So there's two processes really that need to be corrected there. I mean, we could talk about Trump and the wall.
He's
right to build a wall, because there are huge problems with these gangs, particularly the Mexican drug gangs and all of that, and the state needs sovereignty. But who overthrew the government of Honduras in 2008?
Absolutely.
The US had a role in that, and they had a progressive leader who might have had an idea of developing his country, but the US didn't care about that. Hillary Clinton and Obama, they were happy with the military dictatorship there. The US has been imposing all kinds of military dictatorships in these countries. They've never turned up and said, hey, you know, why don't we try and develop this country so that these people can stay there,
you know? Let me ask you this, Garrod, because I'm mindful of the time, and I know you have things to do. Look, we won't waste any time on Brexit. It's a given that it's not going to happen. I predicted that on the 24th of June 2 years ago. I'm no Nostradamus. I'm not known for my predictions, but I did predict the Alexis Tsipras Varoufakis mess before it happened, before they came to power. I got that one right. Look, Brexit is not going to happen, and there will be a second referendum, and it'll be fought on these lines of racism. Let me ask you a question. You described divide and conquer far more eloquently than I have ever described it. And you have, absolutely. When will people like us, I don't mean like you and me, but when will people like us, say indigenous people, now I'm not indigenous to Manchester, I'm in Manchester, but I'm a white Irish guy. If I'm at home, when will the indigenous people and the migrants whose countries have been destroyed, when will they look at one another and go, you know what, we've a common enemy here? I know that sounds very simplistic and foolish and idealistic, but when will light dawn on marble heads and people go, hang on a second, who's really running things? Let's do something about it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what's needed is, first of all, the trap really, I suppose, is if you get a lot of sort of the so-called far right, and they're not interested in kind of more global issues. They just don't want the migrants here, you know.
Yeah.
We don't want migrants here, and there are too many here. But like, do they really have an analysis of globalization? Do they?
No.
Or they might talk about Soros, we don't like him, but yeah, but who is he? I mean, where does he come from? What's the ultimate goal here? You know, that limited approach ultimately leads to resentment. I think, you know, what I see here in the movement here is that, you know, you have, we have a lot of, I do a radio show in French in once a month with Yusuf Hindi, and he's a Muslim scholar, a brilliant scholar, a brilliant writer. He's written really influential books on Islam. And, you know, we have a lot of our listeners are Africans from all over the continent. We get called by them all the time, get letters and you know, emails and stuff. They listen to us because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to, you know, point out who's really running the world, you know, because, you know, right now we're all supposed to hate Donald Trump and all this kind of stuff. And again, and you know, I've kind of said it's not defending Trump, but just like, why are we supposed to hate him?
Yeah.
That's what's more interesting. You know, it's so I think in Ireland, what we would need to do, interestingly, on Brexit, without digressing, on Brexit, you know, you're talking about the migration as one of the aspects here. But in one of the things that has really sickened me about Brexit is in Ireland, particularly in the media, is this idea now, this kind of fake nationalism that you hear, that you see in like the Irish Times, like, oh, Irish people are unwelcome in England now because, you know, the English don't understand us and
nonsense.
They're so arrogant. And they're basically, what they're trying to do is to pretend that they are actually nationalists who are, you know, patriotic Irish who are trying to defend our interests against the bad English. So you've got a lot of pseudo-Anglophobia, basically playing up the nationalist card. The traitors running Dublin, pretending to be nationalists, you know, defending the Irish cause with the border and so on. And then you have the same thing in England, you know, it's sort of like, you know, we don't really care. And so each government is sort of playing a nationalist card actually right now. And it's fake nationalism, you know.
Insincerely.
But I think that in terms of a strategy, one of the most important things is to educate both the native populations, the indigenous populations of Europe, who are being effectively replaced, not just by migration, but the entire social policy, you know, the promotion of all kinds of social programs and schools that are going to, you know, have a devastating impact on the way we live within a generation, you know, population reduction. So the people of Europe need to be educated in that, but also the migrants, the migrant communities, you know, they also, we do need leaders who actually kind of can communicate with them. I haven't seen those leaders that can say to the migrant communities, look, we're not actually your enemies. You know, the guys who brought you here, they're your real enemies.
That's right.
And even if you're getting 15,000 a year, you know, handout, you know, to be a refugee or whatever, long term, this isn't really going to be, this is neither in your interest nor your country's interest, you know.
Do me a favor, Geroat.
If they kind of understand that, then we can avoid civil war. In the movement I'm sort of associated with here, that's what we're trying to do. We're basically trying to educate migrants and, you know, indigenous, the so-called indigenous people on the real issues.
It's the only intellectual approach to calm down and to try and figure out how did we get here. Again, summed up by you saying, let's not say Soros did this, let's find out who the man is, who his allegiances are to, where he came from, what he's trying to do. I'd like you to come back. You talked about writing more and broadcasting more about what's going on in Africa in the coming
sure.
weeks and months. Don't wait to be asked back. I'm on my own here, you see. There is no producer, secretary, editor. It's just me. And it's not that I forget about people, but when you've got something to say, you're always welcome to come back on here. I know you're busy. I know you've got your Press TV, RT work, but when you've got a few minutes, the door is always open to you. It's GerardoColmon.org and it's Broadford Soviet on Twitter if you haven't followed
Thanks a lot, Richie, and great to talk to you again. We could talk all night.
All night,
I hope,
mate,
again, but we talk again soon. There'll be definitely many things coming up, and if anything, you know, anything major happens, I'll definitely give you a bell.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for talking to us about the Gilets Jaunes tonight, putting some perspective, some context on that and everything else. Look after yourself, mate. Slán go fóill.
Likewise. Slán Tomal.
Bye for now. Slán Tomal. The brilliant Geraldo Colmán, live on the Richie Allen Show. Geraldo Colmán. .org and it's at Broadford Soviet. I will, of course, tweet out links to the website for those of you who won't be able to spell Geraud O'Colman, top man. Right, we better move on. It is Tuesday's programme. The meaningful vote is not going to take place in Westminster for at least another 90 minutes, maybe even 2 hours. I won't be on air when it happens. We'll talk about it tomorrow. It's a racing certainty, allegedly, that May is going to suffer one of the all-time great defeats by a sitting Prime Minister. That's what we're being told and have been told for ages. It seems to be absolutely a banker. It's nailed on that she's going to be defeated. What happens then, if and when Jeremy Corbyn decides to sue for a vote of no confidence in Theresa May, whether he'll get the support of the House there, his own party will support him, the Lib Dems, maybe, and maybe the Scottish Nationals will support him. But as long as the DUP are supporting May, it's unlikely that will succeed. So it might just rumble on. Despite the media today trying to portray today as some sort of Armageddon Day, it's just nonsense. It's just that drama, that fake narrative they're building. It's not necessarily Armageddon. It'll be voted down, and then she's got to come back to the House within 3 days with a plan B. It's all a charade. Very soon, the process will be taken out of the government's hands, and there will be, it won't come in the form of an announcement, but there will be more and more and more of a push for an extension to Article 50 to buy more time, to buy Parliament more time, because Parliament is taking control of the process away from government slowly but surely, as we've witnessed in recent days, not so much weeks. And if you've been listening to the monologues on this programme, I've been demonstrating how they have done it, how they've broken with decades, centuries of precedent for MPs to be tabling amendments and adding amendments onto existing bills, and the Speaker of the House, John Bercow, throwing tradition out of the window and rewriting the rules to make it easier for Parliament to take control of the process. Parliament is overwhelmingly in favour of remaining in the European Union. So the vote will happen later. She'll lose. And it won't be the Armageddon, not at least not in the next 24, 36 hours that people say it will. Although, because I've said that now, don't be surprised if Theresa May doesn't resign tomorrow. Richie Allen said nothing would happen. Nothing would happen. That big baldy bollocks. That big bald bollocks said nothing would happen. And then Theresa May fell on her sword. I'm not sure that's going to happen. We're coming up for 13 minutes to the top of the hour. Pretty packed show for Tuesday. Loads of comments on my conversation with Jim Fetzer earlier on. A lot of thoughts there. Interesting stuff. If you missed any of that, of course, you've always got the podcast and the YouTube videos. They will be up when the program is finished. Here's Rod Stewart for you. Rod Stewart, Rhythm of My Heart on the Richie Allen Show. Top song, that. Rich tweets, wouldn't it be great if Theresa May won? Pure comedy if she wins, though, Richie. Would be awesome listening to all the media crawl up their own arses. Yeah, it's like Les Dennis used to say, Rich, if it's up there, I'll give you the money myself. Not sure it'll be up there. Yeah, she's going to lose and lose big. Brexiteers can't stand it, quite rightly, because it isn't leaving the European Union. And the Remainers don't like it because it's they know they've got the government, and they know they've got the whole Brexit process by the short and curlies. The Remainers want more, right? They want no leave, no deal, second referendum. So there's no support for it, really. No support for it. Martin is in Spain. Not a big fan of Rod Stewart, I believe. Oh no, Rod Stewart. Martin, I couldn't give a shite, to be honest. I just choose music that I like. And as a very experienced music DJ and radio presenter, I used to worry a lot in the early days when I played a bit of music and people didn't like it. And I just don't care now. I suppose Rod's a bit like Marmite. I'll give you that. I'll give you that. So interesting weeks and months ahead. Terrific stuff from Garrodo Colmón there, by the way. Very interesting stuff. Fascinating to hear that with Gemma O'Doherty when he spoke with her a few weeks ago, talking about this idea that concern about immigration and the impact of immigration on people's lives in towns and communities, that it's uniquely a right-wing thing. It's bollocks. And I didn't get a chance to mention him, but my friend, who I've mentioned before, my mate Michael, who's a socialist, a real socialist. You don't like that? Again, I don't care either if you don't like real socialists. But he is. He's a good man. And he's a trade unionist. And he laments what's happened to trade unions, and he laments what's happened to the left, because the left today is not the left. We don't have a left anymore. Today's left is that left social democrats. It's that Owen Jones bollocks, Momentum. That's not the left. That's fascism. Screaming at people, telling them what they can and can't think, calling everybody whom you disagree with a Nazi. Not good enough. That's not the left. But my socialist pal talks to me about way back in the 70s, even in the 60s, when socialists were very much putting the case against immigration because of what it would do to wages and working conditions in their communities. Not because they didn't like brown-skinned people. You know, you have to be fairly fucking thick to dislike somebody because of the way they look or because of their sexual orientation. You're not doing well in life. Most people who worry about immigration are not, they don't care about the person's religion or how they look, how they dress, what it is they do when they kneel down to pray. They don't care. And he did really well, Garrod, explaining how the elites used immigration to divide people. And he talked brilliantly, if you missed that conversation, about how the French elites were very worried about the rise of the worker in France, communism, and the workers taking control and the workers becoming militant. And they said in France, the elites, well, we'll see about that. We'll open the floodgates. And we'll give you an enemy to distract you from what it is we're doing. And that's ultimately it, isn't it? It couldn't be any simpler. And yet you wonder, will people ever get that, you know? The person from Pakistan is not your enemy. Honestly. I don't care if the woman wears a burqa or a hijab. I don't care. She's not your enemy. She's not. Would you rather be her or would you rather be you? Would you rather be running from a country that's been carpet bombed back to the Stone Age by the country you're running to for shelter, ironically? These are mad times, aren't they? Maybe people will wake up. Maybe they won't. And if they don't, well, there's worse things happen at sea, you know. There are things you can do. There are other jobs you can do. There are other things in the private sector that we can do rather than broadcast shows like this every night when it isn't making any difference. I'm not saying it isn't. I'm saying in the future. If people don't start getting this, you know, gardening. I'm going to put myself out there as a landscape gardener. Independent. That's what I'll do for a living. It'll just be me and a wheelbarrow. The big baldy bollocks will clean your garden for you. Thanks to Garrodo, Colmon and Jim Fencer. Look after yourselves. Speak to you tomorrow, Wednesday at 5. Bye now.